Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are the world's polar bears in danger of extinction due to climate change, or is it possible they might survive the hardships of longer Arctic summers and melting ice packs? A few years ago, author Zach Unger dreamed his investigations into the effects of climate change on polar bears might serve as a silent spring-style wake-up call for 21st century readers who might still need convincing of the dangers of a warming planet. Alarmed by reports of bears turning to cannibalism to survive, he visited scientists studying bears and charting conditions around the Hudson Bay, and then decided he needed to actually live in the town called the Polar Bear Capital of the World to see for himself how bears were doing. He tells the story of that move to Churchill, Manitoba, along with his wife and three preschool children, in his new book, Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye, a family field trip to the Arctic's edge in search of adventure, truth, and mini marshmallows. Zach, welcome to Think.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So you write here that you ended up in polar bear country specifically because you hope to become a hero of the environmental movement. What made polar bears an obvious choice if you wanted to do that?
Well, you know, it's hard to see climate change. You know, I live in California, and I look out at the San Francisco Bay every day, and it looks like the distance between the water and the Golden Gate Bridge is about the same as it was when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And so it's very hard to get an actual handle on climate change. And I thought that polar bears would be an excellent sentinel species, a way that you could really encapsulate climate change in one sort of easy-to-digest package.
And there had been reports by scientists of polar bears resorting apparently to cannibalism in the summer of 2004. Talk about what made that so alarming to experts.
Well, yeah, I mean, around that period between 2004 and 2008, there had been some reports of polar bears cannibalizing each other. And, you know, polar bears are like any other animal. They don't typically eat each other, you know, for reasons of genetic survival and all. But there had been instances where polar bears were so hungry that scientists had recorded them actually stalking and killing and eating each other to survive.
So before we talk about the overall constraints on their food supply, can you give us a little background on the polar bear sort of eating, hunting, mating cycle in a good year or a typical year when nature sort of behaves as it has in the past?
Yeah, well, different polar bears, and there are 19 different polar bear populations on Earth, and each of them respond to their sort of local conditions. But around Churchill, those bears live through an ice-free summer every year. The ice goes away on Hudson Bay. And so for hundreds of years, since before the Industrial Revolution, polar bears have been experiencing an ice-free summer there. And they don't hibernate, but they spend that sort of summer and fall period sort of doing what they call a walking hibernation, where they try to expend as little energy as possible. And then come November or so, when the ice comes in, they can go back out on the sea ice and hunt. Polar bears can't hunt seals from land. They need the ice. And so they wait for the ice to come in, and then they go out there and hunt.
Why do they need the ice?
Well, because the way that they hunt seals is when seals come up to their little blowholes, their air holes in the ice, the polar bears pounce on them there. Hmm. The seals don't come up on shore. They don't sort of nose around the rocks. And so they need to be, the bears need to be out over open water on this ice in order to hunt seals.
And they'll sit there for sometimes days at a time, right, waiting for a seal to emerge?
Yeah, you know, I had some Inuit elders who told me that everything they know about hunting seals they learned from watching polar bears. Mm. I mean, polar bears are incredibly smart. They will sometimes get a block of ice and push it up to a seal blowhole and hide behind that block of ice as camouflage for days, just waiting for that moment when the seal noses its way up.
So, Zach, how long do polar bears go in the summer without eating anything?
Well, it's getting longer and longer. I mean, polar bears can go for, you know, 5 to 6 months without eating. And the pregnant moms who are denning will go even longer than that. And, you know, they are eating other things on land, but their dominant food is seals. And so they are experiencing 5 to 6 months with very, very little food intake.
And what happens to their bodies? I guess they have a store of fat that they build up in the winter and use during the lean times?
Yeah, polar bears are all fat. That's what their stock in trade is. And they eat the fat off seals and eat the fat off walruses. And they basically just starve and try to conserve energy during that time.
So you mentioned that they can eat other things. Am I right that in the past, a lot of scientists thought that their sole diet, their sole prey, was seals?
Right. This has been sort of the conventional wisdom, that polar bears eat seals and seals only. And there's starting to be more evidence that polar bears do have a more varied diet. I mean, they've been found eating caribou and geese and starfish and fish and kelp and really anything that they can eat. And one interesting thing is that there's been an explosion in the snow goose population in the far north. And so all of a sudden there are tens of thousands of nesting pairs of snow geese up in the far north. And there's been a scientific paper theorizing that, you know, if a bear eats something like 40 nests of polar bears, that equals the caloric value of one seal. So which is not to suggest that, you know, they can completely go off seals, but there is an emerging body of evidence suggesting that there are other things that polar bears can eat.
So talk about the sort of global hotshots of the study of polar bears and their accessibility to you and what it took for you to make contact.
You know, polar bear scientists, there aren't very many of them. It's not like people who study white mice. I mean, it's this sort of very, very small group. I took to calling them the heavy hitters of polar bear science. And what I found is that getting one of these heavy hitters to return your phone call is like getting Mick Jagger to perform at your Labor Day picnic. I mean, these guys are just incredibly in demand. They're on the front page of the New York Times. They're testifying in front of Congress. They're on Entertainment Tonight doing, you know, various B-list celebrity promos to save the polar bears. And so it's hard to get at them. And I called and I called and I called. And there were a few of them in particular who I really wanted to get at. And it wasn't until the very end of my investigation that I was able to get an audience with these guys.
And you did have better luck with someone who is maybe not as well known, that his students call the Rock.
Yeah, you know, about a few months into sort of trying to get access to these guys, one of my contacts asked me if I'd ever contacted a professor by the name of Rocky Rockwell, and I hadn't heard of him. But it turns out that this guy had spent 40 years up in the wilds outside of Churchill. He's a population biologist, and he had been studying geese and polar bears and sort of everything that lives up in that area. And he, in fact, actually had more polar bear encounters and more polar bear experience than any of the other heavy hitters. But he was a little bit of an outlier. He wasn't quite in the club. But he was doing incredible work on polar bear population dynamics. And he invited me to spend a couple of weeks with him at his polar bear camp. I mean, this is out in the middle of nowhere. You can only access it by helicopter. And I spent a few weeks out there with him studying polar bears and their diet and their population.
And in addition to the work that they're doing and the information that they're documenting, these people make a sacrifice in terms of lifestyle. They're eating on like ramen noodles and peanut butter and tuna.
Oh, I mean, to call this place a camp is generous. I mean, it is like it's like in some sort of post-apocalyptic Mad Max scene. I mean, it's this collection of sort of old rundown shacks dropped in the middle of this river. It's incredibly hot in the summer. It's incredibly buggy, and the entire place is ringed by electric fence because they are under constant assault, essentially, by polar bears. There are polar bears everywhere, and if you don't have that fence, you're in trouble.
So what makes Rocky so iconoclastic as compared with some of his peers?
Well, one thing is that he is willing to say that polar bears are eating things other than seals, but he also has been looking at the evidence and looking at all of the population dynamics of bears from all of the different populations, and he does not necessarily believe that polar bears are in as dire straits as we have been led to believe. Now, you know, one piece of evidence that he told me that really blew my mind was that there are more polar bears alive today than there were 40 years ago. Now, this is because there was a global hunting ban in the early 70s, and the population exploded. So this is not to say that global warming isn't real or that it's not going to be a problem for polar bears. But this is an essentially heartening, cheerful piece of information that hasn't managed to pierce the public consciousness somehow.
And I guess, is the idea, there's this sort of existential question as to whether, you know, biologists should be simply recorders of facts as scientists, or if they need to have an advocacy role. Is that the issue?
Yeah, you know, after I'd been working on this book for about 6 months, I realized that I wasn't just writing about polar bears. I was actually writing about sort of the commission of proper science. And the polar bear has become such an iconic animal and such an incredible symbol for global warming that there has been this tendency to blur the lines between science and advocacy. And a lot of the scientists, these heavy hitters, have really adopted a sort of PR role. And the problem with that is that they are then opening themselves up to the same sort of political demagoguery that anyone in politics face. Whereas I feel like scientists need to let the numbers speak for themselves, let science sort of take its many twists and turns, and not hold tight to a firm political narrative.
Is the idea among some scientists that they have to sort of hold to this line or else all the rest of us in the world will think, no big deal, we don't have to worry about climate change, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And you know, I want to say at the outset that all of these scientists who are working on polar bears are they're doing good work and they have only the best intentions. Mm-hmm. But if you say something like, polar bears are all going to be dead by 2050, you're making a political point, not a scientific one. And so Anstrup, one of the heavy hitters, had started to make these sort of date-certain predictions. And those get latched onto by the press. The press loves a date certain that extinction is going to happen by. But science is nonlinear, and there are weird local effects, and there are some polar bear populations on Earth that are doing quite well. And so if you start making these political points as a scientist, the other side is going to say, well, what about this and this and this? And then you're no longer free to say, well, there are ups and downs, but we need to look at the trend, because you've just said there's no trend, there's just certain doom.
Mm-hmm. So each year, polar bears travel to the edge of the Arctic, as you mentioned. They sort of wait for the water to freeze over, which puts them right in the area where human residents of this little town called Churchill, Manitoba, make their homes. Can you talk about the place?
Yeah, you know, Churchill is this incredible small town. It's on the shores of Hudson Bay in northern Manitoba, and there are about 1,000 people who live there. And then every fall, there are about 1,000 polar bears who live there as well in this tiny little town. And, I mean, people in Churchill know that there are going to be polar bears walking down the street. You're going to see polar bear in your front yard. People leave their homes and cars unlocked, and it's perfectly good form to duck into a stranger's house if you're being chased by a polar bear. I mean, people have these, what they call a Churchill welcome mat, which is a piece of plywood with hundreds of nails sticking out from it that they lay on their front porch so that when the polar bear comes up to knock on the door, he's going to get a fistful of nails, which only works for polar bears who are polite enough to come to the front door. And I had people tell me about polar bears who put their fist through the siding of a house to get at a piece of meat that was defrosting on top of a fridge. So, I mean, it's a very, very unique little town with a set of risks and things to worry about that aren't faced really anywhere else.
And they have this really sort of nuanced relationship to these animals. They know they're dangerous, they recognize they're a threat, and yet it's sort of their stock in trade as well.
Yeah, you know, people call Churchill the polar bear capital of the world, but it's also the polar bear tourist capital of the world. Every fall, about 10,000 tourists descend on the town for this sort of frantic six-week period. And, you know, people want to sort of check polar bears off their life list, and this is the best and easiest way to see them. And so the town just completely transforms itself into this tourist mecca. I mean, there's this sort of sleepy little coffee shop, and all of a sudden you've got to get reservations 3 weeks ahead to have dinner there because the town is just so overrun by polar bear tourists.
So when you first arrived, did residents think of you as another one of these tourists?
Yes, definitely. And, you know, it's an insular town, and they get just overrun by polar bear scientists and media. And, you know, it's the easiest place to look at polar bears. I mean, a lot of places where polar bears live, there's no good coffee shop. There's not a place to get an internet connection. And so because this place is sort of accessible, everyone goes there. And I was sort of people were standoffish originally because they've seen so many reporters, and most reporters just sort of parachute in for a day or two, whereas I moved my whole family up there, and we camped out for a couple of months, and so I tried to really get to know people better.
We'll talk more about that in just a couple of minutes with author Zach Unger. His new memoir is called Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye, a family field trip to the Arctic's edge in search of adventure, truth, and mini marshmallows. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Zach Unger. His new book is called Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye, a family field trip to the Arctic's edge in search of adventure, truth, and mini marshmallows. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Zach, I know that your wife is no stranger to very, very cold weather, but I gather you live in Oakland for a reason. What sort of thinking did you put into broaching the idea with her that you felt as if you had to go and live in Churchill for a while?
Yeah, you know, when I suggested that we sort of pull our kids out of school, head up to the middle of nowhere, and use them as polar bear bait, she wasn't exactly giving me any Father of the Year awards, but... You know, we live this very sort of, you know, I've got a minivan, I'm on the PTA board, I go to the farmer's market on the weekends. I live this very sort of conventional California life that you recognize. And there was a bit of an element of sort of midlife crisis and adventure to this. And so when I said, hey, I'd like to do this adventurous thing, she was more game than you would think. And it was a grand adventure to really break ourselves out of our normal lifestyle and go to a place that was entirely alien to us.
And what about your kids? I guess they had varying degrees of excitement about the possibility of seeing a polar bear.
Yeah, you know, my middle son, Mac, he's this sort of semi-feral wild child. I mean, he wishes that he could have been raised by wolves, right? He should have been on the frontier 150 years ago. Mm. And so when I told him that we were, you know, when we came up to this town where there are wild animals around every corner that might rip your head off and everyone carries a gun and nobody wears their seatbelt, I mean, it was like this Arctic Huck Finn childhood dream for him. And so he really took to it immediately. My daughter, on the other hand, you know, she couldn't have been bothered to look up from her coloring books if a bunch of polar bears had marched through the living room in formation. But my son Mac was really just enamored of this place.
And there are, I mean, people in general, but particularly people with young children, have to take some precautions to live in Churchill.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was talking to different people about sort of what level of worry I should have. And, you know, one young mom told me that these kids look just like seals in their snowsuits. And if you've got your kid out in the front yard playing, you've got to be worried about polar bears. And so we kind of tried to walk that line between, you know, safety and living your life. I mean, you can't just lock yourself in the bathroom forever. And so we came to learn, like as I do in Oakland, which neighborhoods not to go into, what times of day are safe in certain places. But that being said, there's always an element of risk. And when you're pushing a four-year-old in a stroller down Main Street, you're always looking over your shoulder to see if there's a bear on the way.
And Halloween is an interesting ritual there.
Yeah, Halloween is crazy. I mean, basically what you do is you take these tiny little children who are already like, you know, bite-sized treat for a polar bear, and then you stuff them full of candy and you take them out in the dark. And so what happens in Churchill is that, I mean, you can't cancel Halloween because you'd have a mutiny on your hand, but instead you go trick-or-treating under armed guard. Basically, every able-bodied person who knows how to work a gun in Churchill comes out and they sort of cover you while you're trick-or-treating, and you go house to house, and the mounted police and the military and all the local guys are out there with their shotguns covering you. And there's one main rule for Halloween, which is that children can't dress up as princesses or brides or anything white, because when you've got a bunch of trigger-happy guys looking in the shadows for polar bears, you don't want any mistakes to be made.
Hmm. So how common are human polar bear encounters?
Quite common, actually. I mean, there are polar bears in that October-November period. There are polar bears in town almost all the time. And they're not disastrous encounters, because the town of Churchill has come up with this very innovative program called the Polar Bear Alert System. What it is if you see a polar bear in town, you get on your phone and you call 675-BEAR, and then a bunch of guys from the conservation agency come out in a pickup truck, and they have a system where they haze and scare the bears out of town. They use firecrackers and then rubber bullets and, if need be, actual bullets. But they have a remarkable record of chasing bears out of town. It used to be, you know, 20, 30 years ago before the program started, that a lot of bears died because local residents would just shoot them.
Yeah.
Completely understandably. But this polar bear alert program tries to do it without destroying bears, and they've been incredibly effective.
So there are some bears that are sort of ejected from town and then keep coming back and have to go to what amounts to polar bear jail.
Yeah, they have a polar bear jail outside of China, and you know they're very official about it. It's actually the, you know, polar bear holding facility, and it's so secret it's like Guantanamo. They won't let you look in. They won't tell you how many bears are there. But
there's no warrants.
Right, exactly. No review. I used to think it was for, I initially thought it was for sort of the most incorrigible bears, and they would get a sentence. But what it is that the bears that can't stop coming into town, they take them and they put them in this polar bear jail, and they basically just sit there. They're not given any food. They're just given snow to drink. You know, they don't want it to be a reward, not a place to get food. And then the bears just sit there and they wait out the fall season. And then when Hudson Bay freezes up again, you can open up the jail and let the bears go back out onto the bay. I mean, a lot of times it's those sort of juvenile, sub-adult bears who don't quite have the sense to stay away like the older bears do.
For people who might just be tuning in, I want to point out that it's not the fact that they're not given food is not so different from what they might find in the wild. They're not being deliberately starved. They wouldn't be eating out in the wild as well. That's
exactly
at this point. Okay.
Exactly.
What about airlifting? How often are bears removed that way?
They do occasionally airlift bears, you know, if the jail is getting full or you know, sometimes they'll take moms and cubs out on an airlift, and they take the bears as far away as they can. In the past, they had problems with flying bears away, and then the bears would just walk back into town. The reason that the bears come to Churchill is because that's the place where the ice freezes first, and the bears know this year after year. That's why they're coming to Churchill. But airlifting is certainly something that happens. It's very expensive, and there's always a risk because it involves drugging the bears and then tying the bear to this net underneath the helicopter. So it's a big procedure, and they probably do it a couple of times a year.
We have an email here from Hillary who asks, what role do polar bears play in the world, and why is it so important to keep them alive?
Well, I mean, in one sense, all animals play an important role in the world, and there is this sort of interconnected web of species. But on the other hand, you know, polar bears are the top of the food chain. And if polar bears go extinct, there's not a lot of other animals that are going to go extinct because of them. I mean, Arctic foxes eat the leavings of polar bear kills. But so it's hard to say that something horrible would happen if all the polar bears went away. But polar bears are these top of the food chain species are sentinel species. They are the canary in the coal mine, if you will. And as they go away, it presages problems for other more sort of widespread species.
You mentioned that the population, I think it was like 5,000 in 1970-something, and now it's 20 to 25,000 globally. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it was that earlier number in the 70s is disputed, but they were clearly on the very edge of extinction back then, and they're much healthier now.
I mean, what are the arguments for just expanding if, you know, is there an outright prohibition on hunting them everywhere in the world that they exist in the wild?
No, there still is hunting. Hunting is mostly limited to native populations in the five polar bear regions, and so there is still some hunting going on, much, much less than it was before when you could sort of buy a hunting tag and just go up there and shoot one. There's actually a prohibition now on bringing polar bear hides into the United States. So if you go up to Canada, hunters can't bring back their trophies. So that's had a chilling effect. But some of the native populations do still hunt, and the native populations actually often advocate for increased hunting because it's a source of income, a source of food, and a real important native sort of heritage right for them.
How much work has been done by scientists in connecting with these native populations who might have knowledge about polar bears based on thousands of years of interactions that scientists, try as they might, can't get even in a decades-long career?
You know, it depends on where. I mean, some places have been extremely good about incorporating native traditional knowledge. And then in other places, I talked to native people who say, hey, these people from the South come up and they tell us what's going on and they never talk to us. And so it's kind of a back-and-forth thing. And one thing that I found curious is that, not exclusively, but a good proportion of the native folks who live far up north feel like polar bear populations are healthier than ever. They feel like they're seeing more polar bears than they ever have, and so they have a hard time reconciling that with the scientists who tell them that, you know, the sky is falling.
Is the discussion of possibly falling, declining populations, is that good for the tourism industry?
You know, it probably is good for the tourism industry. I mean, people go because they want to see this animal just before it drops off the face of the earth, and so that they can say, oh, my God, I went up there and I saw these animals and they were so skinny and they were so starving. So there's a little bit of that prurient interest. And you know, it's unavoidable, and the companies do the business that they want to do.
Mm-hmm. How well do the tourists behave? I mean, are they pretty respectful of nature and of the lives of the private individuals who live in Churchill?
you know, I think any tourist town has its share of people who are doing crazy things. For the most part, tourists are very well managed and very well behaved. But you know, every year there's a couple of tourists who, as one guide said to me, they go out there looking for Narnia, and they have this feeling like, I can just step out, you know, from behind the bars, and I can have this sort of soulful communication with the bear and look into his eyes, and we'll just have this interspecies love, and you know, which is all well and good until the bear, you know, eats your kidneys. And so people like that are immediately put on the first flight south. But every year there's a couple people who have that sort of mystical idea.
What exactly are you supposed to do if you find yourself within sight distance of a polar bear and you are outside?
Well, you know, the title of the book, Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye, was a piece of advice that my son got from a five-year-old local, which is, if you come up on a polar bear, don't look it in the eye, because that means that you want to fight. Mm. And, you know, my son's pretty tough, but he's not allowed to fight polar bears. So the general idea is you sort of look away, look deferential, don't run, and sort of start slowly backing away and get into the first car or structure you can find.
And you had a bit of a close call with your two-year-old, is that right?
Yeah, you know, I was pushing a stroller down the street. We were just coming back from the grocery store, and I wasn't paying much attention, and he's sort of looking out and yelling, "Dog, dog, dog, there's a dog." And, you know, of course, there's dogs all over the place. I didn't really pay much attention to it. But when I looked up, I realized what he thought was a dog was actually a polar bear. We lived right on the edge of town, and there was a polar bear, you know, basically just across the street from us. So we ditched the groceries and hustled inside real quick. And this is the kind of thing, if you live in Churchill for long enough, you're guaranteed to have a polar bear encounter. Everybody does.
Hmm. How are the people in a town that small, do they all sort of know each other? And what is the social climate like?
Yeah, I mean, everyone knows each other. There's 1,000 people there. And because the conditions are so difficult with the heat and the cold and the bugs and the bears, you know, there's this real sort of esprit de corps, and people really pull together. There are, you know, you go up there and you're like, oh my God, what have people ever seen in this town? But it doesn't take long to realize that it's this very sort of starkly beautiful place and this dynamic sense of community. People pull together, they take care of each other. I mean, there's not a road up to Churchill, so everything has to come by plane or by train. So if you run out of something, you're kind of out of luck. And so everyone really, you know, they help each other with their construction projects. They pull together in a really wonderful way.
And something as simple as, like, a watermelon is a precious gift.
Oh, my God. You know, I there was one woman there who, she was sort of caressing this watermelon. I came into her office like it was a baby. And, you know, this watermelon probably cost $15. You know, it was a prize. I brought her some chocolate, thinking that was a nice gift. But she couldn't care less about the chocolate. Just having fresh fruit. I mean, a gallon of milk up there can cost $12 or $14. A head of lettuce is $6. I mean, if you want to do the 100-mile local diet in Churchill, that means you're basically eating Churchill or eating caribou and nothing else.
Hmm. How involved is the Canadian government in tracking and quantifying the populations of its polar bears?
Quite involved. You know, a lot of the polar bear tracking is done by the provinces and the territories, not necessarily by the federal government. And so there ends up being some dispute between some of the provinces over how the polar bear populations are doing, because polar bears will sort of go from one province to another, and you can end up having one polar bear conceivably managed by four different provinces or territories. And so there is some dispute amongst the provinces. You know, polar bears are the species that range all over the Arctic, and so there are issues where polar bears will go not just from one province to another, but from one country to another. And so you have to come up with global solutions.
Can you talk, Zach, about these stories that many people have heard about polar bears being found having drowned and what that indicates and how that might happen?
Yeah, there was a paper a few years ago in which one of the polar bears that they tagged was observed swimming 690 kilometers offshore, you know, a distance of 690 kilometers. Now, polar bears are classified as marine mammals, and they can swim incredibly well. But the problem is that as global warming advances and the distance between ice flows and the distance between the sea ice and the shore expands, they're spending considerably more time swimming. And this is a huge energy cost for them while they're burning calories, and it's also an opportunity cost. The time that they spend swimming is time that they couldn't, that they're not spending hunting. And so this increased swimming is quite difficult for them. Now, that being said, polar bears swim. And when you see a picture of a polar bear swimming or a polar bear sort of sitting on this very tiny ice floe, it's not evidence that global warming has, you know, taken all the ice away. Polar bears do swim, and they always swim in off the ice every year. So you have to kind of look at that judiciously.
How social are they as animals?
You know, they're not super social. During the fall, they'll sort of circle near each other and do those kind of kabuki-style fights where they're not really trying to kill each other. But they're not incredibly social. One thing that's interesting about polar bears is that the moms stay with their cubs for up to 3 years, which is much longer than most mammals do. Because the environment is so harsh, because seal hunting is so difficult and there's so much to learn, the mothers really spend a lot of time and energy invested in the cubs.
And they're having fewer cubs now per pregnancy than they used to.
Yeah, that's one thing scientists are finding. I mean, once a polar bear survives into adulthood, it's pretty hardy and it can deal with some lean years. But they're finding that polar bears are less likely to have triplets or twins than they used to, and they're finding that cub survival rates are going down. So while the polar bear population might be stable now, if cub survival is going down, that's a huge risk going forward.
And have scientists been able to identify why some of the 19 populations that are scattered throughout the Arctic are doing all right and some are really struggling, and what the differences might be in the geographic area?
Right. So there are 19 polar bear populations, about a third of whom are in trouble, about a third of which we don't know what's going on, and about a third of which are stable or improving. And there are some local effects, like in some areas you know, hunting has gone way down, and so populations have exploded. There's one area where a certain kind of seal hunt was banned, and so the seal population exploded. And then also, you know, kind of interestingly, there are some populations in which global warming will actually help polar bears. I mean, contrary to popular belief, polar bears don't love it when it's negative 40. There are some areas far north that are just too harsh. And in fact, there are some areas where the sea ice is so thick that polar bears can't hunt. So as global warming advances, there are going to be areas in the far, far north that may actually become more inhabitable by polar bears.
My guest is author Zach Unger. His new memoir is called Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye, a family field trip to the Arctic's edge in search of adventure, truth, and mini marshmallows. Join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Zach Unger about his new memoir, Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye, a family field trip to the Arctic's edge in search of adventure, truth, and mini marshmallows. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have Bob on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Bob.
Howdy.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I'm just curious if the Mr. Unger might know something I've wondered about for years. I read once that the U.S. Navy's Arctic Survival Manual for generally for aviators who might crash land in those climates has a single sentence in there that says, never eat the liver of a polar bear. It has no other explanation. Is that something that the natives or residents are aware of or can explain?
Yeah, I do know a little bit about that. The polar bear liver has really high concentrations of vitamin A, so high that they're toxic. And if you eat a polar bear liver, you can actually get, I don't remember the medical term for it, but you can get vitamin A poisoning. And when you read the journals of Samuel Hearn and Monk and some of the people who went to explore Hudson Bay in the 16 and 1700s, a lot of their men came down with these sort of horrible diseases that they didn't know what it was, and they died from it. And it's been theorized now that this vitamin A toxicity was a problem and that people were dying from that. And the natives definitely do know that. They don't eat the liver. Also, polar bear meat has a high rate of trichinosis in it, so you have to cook it incredibly well. You got to know how to eat a polar bear.
I was interested to read that when a bear has been, say, tranquilized to tag it or to move it or something, it's dyed in a certain way so that natives will know not to eat that particular bear until, I guess, the dye has worn away?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of concern among the native community about what tranquilizing a bear and what handling a bear does to it. And so they put this big green splotch on it to tell the natives, don't eat this bear because it's got those sort of whatever those tranquilizer drugs are coursing through it. But in general, the natives tend to feel like there's just too much bear handling going on. I mean, around Churchill, it's been theorized that 80% of those bears have been tranquilized at least one time, many of them many more times. And, you know, the scientists are doing honorable things. They're trying to measure them, and they're trying to figure out what's going on. But they also have observed that the more you handle a bear, the less ability it has to hunt. I mean, there are always risks with tranquilizing a bear. And so, you know, some people have suggested, why not a moratorium for a while on capturing these bears and just sort of messing with them?
Is it easy for experts to tell one polar bear from another visually?
You know, I don't know about visually. Some people can tell them, you know, from the scars on their nose. But what they do is when they catch a bear, they tattoo the inside of their lip mm-hmm. with a number, and so that way you can tell one bear from another. And that's how you do population surveys: is you continually catch bears, and the more often you catch a certain bear, helps you make a guesstimate of how big the population is.
Well, you've got to have great faith in polar bear tranquilizer technology to be the first guy to volunteer to tattoo the inside of a bear's lip.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you don't want to tranquilize the bear so much that it stops breathing. And, you know, I've had scientists tell me that they're down there on their knees working with this bear when it starts to come to, or even worse, you know, a bear starts coming to when it's, you know, hanging underneath a net in a helicopter. So you got to have your drugs calibrated just right.
We have an email here from David in Plano who writes, can you comment on polar grizz or prizzly bears where polar bears and grizzlies crossbreed? Is this an outgrowth of global warming, and will it be more common in the future, or is it just an isolated phenomenon?
Well, they are finding that, you know, as global warming advances, grizzly bears are moving northwards, and they are finding these hybrids between polar bears and grizzlies, Pizzly bear or growler bear, whatever you want to call it. And so they have found them. And the truth is that, you know, the definition of a species is two kinds of animals that can't interbreed and have viable offspring. Now, polar bears and grizzlies have separated from each other not that long ago. And technically, they're still one species. They can interbreed. Now, grizzly bears have a much more varied diet than polar bears. And so maybe this sort of interbred mix will be a way for sort of polar bear genetic material to survive. There hasn't been a lot of research done on it so far, but they definitely have reported these growler bears.
How well do they breed in captivity?
You know, I don't know very much about what happens to polar bears in zoos. And, you know, to me, seeing a polar bear in a zoo is a terrible, sad thing. I mean, they need huge areas to roam over. And I understand that polar bears are an incredible draw for zoos and maybe a way to sort of get people excited about polar bears. But in general, for me, I think polar bears need space and they need to be out there.
So as you reported over these months that you spent in Churchill, I mean, did you feel conflicted about the fact that the story presented to you was ultimately more nuanced than the sort of polemic that you initially expected to write?
Yeah, you know, I set out to write this sort of mournful obituary for the bears, and I found that I couldn't do that, which was great news for the bears and terrible news for my book. You know, and, you know, talking to these scientists who had kept saying things like polar bears will all be extinct by 2050, or, you know, cannibalism is happening and it's rampant, you know, it really felt to me like there had been a blurring of the line between science and advocacy. And it's very important to me because what happens if 2050 rolls around and polar bears are not extinct, but some other animal is in trouble? Will we be able to trust scientists then? And for me, the commission of proper science and the ability of the public and policymakers to trust scientists is far more important than any one particular debate about any species or another.
What did you learn about the way that debate is playing out in the scientific community?
You know, well, one thing is that there is a debate in the scientific community, which is not something I knew. I mean, I didn't even realize that there were sort of credible, credentialed scientists who believe that polar bears are doing better than we thought. And so it's unfortunate to me the way both scientists have become politicians and the way that the media has run with one particular narrative. I think it's very important that we look at science with all of its warts and say, you know, sometimes the evidence points this way, sometimes the evidence points that way. But we cannot let our scientists become advocates.
One thing that you did not find was scientists who did not believe that global climate change is taking place. Am I correct about that?
Yes. I mean, global climate change is taking place. There is no debate about that. And it's been very interesting. You know, my book and my idea that polar bears are doing better than you thought has been sort of taken up in a firestorm way by the right. And I've been, you know, my stuff has been on every right-wing Ann Coulter, Glenn Beck, Fox News. And they all want to say that because polar bears are doing better than you thought, that means global warming isn't happening. Well, that's not true at all, but it's a very easy sort of polemic to make. And so, you know, I can't think of any other animal that drives people to distraction as quickly as polar bears. As soon as you say polar bear, people start screaming about global warming. Global warming is absolutely happening, but the problem is that polar bears have become the center ring of this circus, and they have the potential to distract from the real cause and the real story, which is global warming, rather than add to public knowledge.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. My guest is Zach Unger. When you went back to your life in California, what did you miss about Churchill, Manitoba?
You know, there's this sort of feeling of adventure and being on the frontier. I mean, in Churchill, you might not have a nice house or, you know, a organic vegetable garden or whatever, but you're never going to get bored. I mean, you're always going to be sort of living that sort of life on the edge that you know, sort of our ancestors did, you know, a couple hundred years ago. And there's something about that feeling of a little bit of danger and a little bit of being out in the world and the elements without that safety net that's really appealing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jerry on the line in Colleyville. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Great story. I used to work at a zoo, and you know, seeing a bear in captivity was one of the saddest things. And so hopefully it won't come to that. We can keep them alive. But I just read an article in Science News about removing primary predators from the food chain, and this was specifically talking about fish, you know, primary predators in the ocean. But polar bears are pretty well connected to the ocean, so their removal would have, an impact on the food chain. And it was kind of shocking because the removal of the primary predators from the ocean had, in this study, a 93% decrease in the sequestration of carbon in the parts of the ocean that they were studying, because the primary predators, you know, they eat something, that eat something, that happens to, you know, you leave some critters, you know, along at the bottom of the food chain, and they eat up all the phytoplankton and seaweed, and so it has a huge impact. So just wanted to throw that in there. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
You know, I'm not familiar with that study exactly, but the truth is that, you know, top of the food chain predators do have they have bigger effects on us as people than they may have actually out in the world. I mean, it's easy to see why polar bears have become the symbol of global warming. I mean, they're cute, they're cuddly, they're furry, they're ferocious, they nurture their young, they're a lot like us. And so it's hard to get people excited about some kind of sea cucumber that might be going extinct because of global warming. But polar bears really are an excellent stand-in. But at the same time, a lot of the sort of debate and the value that we place on polar bears is theoretical. I mean, 99.9% of people on Earth have never seen a polar bear and will never see a polar bear. So if I tell you there are 25,000 polar bears, is that really any different to your life than if there were 2,000 polar bears, if you live in Dallas? And, you know, they've done these studies. How much is a polar bear worth to you? How much would you be willing to pay to ensure the survival of the polar bears? And the answer is about $750. You know, people say, I'd give maybe $1,000 to preserve polar bears. But polar bears are really kind of a theoretical concept for a lot of people, as opposed to something that you see every day.
Do you now apply different kinds of filters to news that you might see or read or hear about Arctic wildlife in general and polar bears in particular?
I do. I mean, when I see scientists who are funded by advocacy groups or environmental organizations, that immediately makes me a little bit suspicious. I mean, if you saw a scientist who was funded by Exxon, you would say, oh, well, this is a problem. You know, he's been a victim of industry capture. But there's just as much of a problem of a scientist being funded by a political organization on the left, a conservation organization. And so I do look at funding sources very clearly. I love it when scientists just put out the numbers and say, I don't know what this number means. I don't necessarily have any policy prescription for it. But when scientists both put out a number and start running the media chain with it as well, that makes me initially suspicious.
So what can we do to foster more science that has absolutely no particular cause attached, given that the motivation for people to fund a lot of this research is to, I don't want to say always confirm a bias, is to research things that they happen to be passionate about?
Well, I mean, I think we need more funding both for government science and for university science. And there's a value for pure research that doesn't necessarily have an outcome attached to it. When you are asking people to do polar bear research just in advance of a debate about whether polar bears should be listed as threatened, you can't help but have political aims come in. And I think that we need to allow that negative results and stable results are just as interesting as positive results. I mean, you know, you're in the media, a headline like that says catastrophe approaches is much more interesting than a headline that says things are guardedly stable. So we need to fund science to such a level that they can put out sort of equivocal and sort of stable science, as opposed to always jumping from one crisis to the next.
How long ago did you actually get back home?
You know, I actually made 5 trips up there total, and the long trip we did was in 2008.
Okay. So do your kids remember anything about the experience?
My older 2 kids do. And, you know, I mean, a lot of those memories are probably invented memories at this point. But, yeah, they definitely remember it. And, you know, my middle son, when he saw a polar bear, that was maybe the only time in his life that I've ever seen him not talk. I mean, his jaw was just, you know, down around his knees, and he definitely remembers that.
So an adventure that you'd recommend to other families?
Yeah, anytime you can break out of your life and do something that just shocks yourself and your system and your kid's system, I recommend it.
Zach Unger's new memoir is called Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye, a family field trip to the Arctic's edge in search of adventure, truth, and mini marshmallows. Zach, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about Think and find out about upcoming programs, plus download the podcast at kera.org/think. You can email any comments, questions, or suggestions for the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.